So my background, I didn't start out as a technologist. I did the business school in 92 and founded a company, grew it as fast as I possibly could. And I've pretty much been in technology ever since. So one of the things I'm going to run through with you today is that 4 years ago, I decided to train as a futurist. And so I went to the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto. And I have worked as a futurist, particularly in the areas of disruptive technology, for the last few years. So this is my first slide. And I don't know how many of you are science fiction fans, but I want you to think about this idea that the future is already here and it's all around us. It's not very evenly distributed. What we mean by that is, I was thinking today about what I call like whispers from the future. And so my idea about whispers from the future is that, you have that inkling, you see things and you think, oh my God, that's how it's going to be in 10 years' time or 20 years' time. I remember buying a Newton. I don't know if any of you remember what a Newton was, but it was pre-Palm Pilot and it was a personal organizer. And I remember thinking, wow, this is going to be quite cool. The problem that Apple had with that Newton was that there really wasn't any internet anywhere. And so this was a device that would have been perfect in an internet-connected era, but really didn't make any sense at the time that it came out. But I remember holding it in my hand and thinking, oh my God, this is something from the future. And so when we look around us, we might think about AI, we might think about robotics, we might think about all kinds of technologies. But I want you to think about technologies don't take off in a linear way. And I'm going to have fun now with this, am I? Oh, here we go. Sorry, just learning how to use the Zoom technology. So here we go. So this slide here, I want you to think about what it was like in 1900. This is Fifth Avenue in New York City, and that little circle there contains the first automobile on the streets of New York. Oh, one before. Oh yeah, this one. So what we have here is, I want you to think about what it's like when one of your neighbors or someone you know or someone in your industry does something that is kind of weird and random. Because that's how it will have felt for that guy, and it was a guy who was the first person in New York with a car. So if you think about it, at the time they built places in New York with stables in them because rich people had horses so that they could get those carts around that you can see everybody else is driving in. There was no infrastructure that made the car make sense in New York in 1900. There were no petrol stations, there were no mechanics. There were none of the bits and pieces of life that made a car make a whole lot of sense. And I recently read a report that was written by the town planners in New York in 1900. And they said that it was a fact that Manhattan would never be fully built out. And the reason that Manhattan would never be fully built out was that there were not enough horses to move the building materials around New York. And I want you to think about that because we look at the future through the lens of the past, and we look at the future as a way that we reflect on what we know about our present and we take that into our future. And if you think about this guy, he kind of was a bit crazy because he actually still had to own a horse. And the reason he had to own a horse was he had to have a horse go down to the docks to pick up the petrol to put into that car. And so it really was a bit of a folly. But I want you to have a look at what New York looked like just 13 years later. And we think that change is accelerating, but actually, this change, the change from the horse and cart to the change to the automobile, was incredibly fast and incredibly efficient. And one of the big things that happened that made it work was that infrastructure came into place that made this work. So if I think about the technology that I play with, I started working on a mainframe in the 1980s. And that mainframe, I had to code to go on the internet. And for those young people in the room, this isn't going to turn into like cute old people talking about the internet stories. What it is to think about that when I started using that technology in the 1980s, I had no idea that it was going to be so ubiquitous that I there weren't even mobile phones, so I couldn't imagine that I could be sitting across the world like this, doing a webinar with you guys in real time. That was beyond consideration. And so the same here in that 13-year gap between the horse being dominant in New York and the car being dominant in New York was inconceivable for people that it would change that fast. And then once it had changed, it was inconceivable for people that it could ever go back. But what I want you to have a think about was that it wasn't the car technology that changed in that 13 years. What it was the infrastructure. What it was the business models that were around the car made it easy for people to own cars. So there were car sales yards. There were petrol stations started to move in. Mechanics moved in. People who cleaned the cars, people who maintained and drove those cars. And so there was disruption. But think about like the number of jobs that this created. And so every change in technology creates a whole new era of jobs that goes with it. And so again, if you look at these cars, very few of these cars in 1913 will have actually been driven by their owners. In this time, other people will have learnt to drive and picked up jobs as drivers. And so even though the horses were displaced and the people who looked after the horses, a whole new economy developed, and that's what enabled the car to really take off. So, you know, you'll probably know what killed Blockbuster, and I laugh because I saw a video store the other day, and my local one finally closed down just recently. Every time I drove past it, I used to think, oh my God, are they selling drugs? Do you know, it just made no sense to me that this video store was still there, and I couldn't understand a business model that would make a video store work. And again, humor me if you're younger than me here, but for the rest of us, you know, we used to go down here on a Friday night. We would like spend hours with our friends trying to work out what we were going to borrow. We'd finally agree on a movie. You'd go to get the movie and it would be out and you could have it on Tuesday and you couldn't have it today. There were no search tools. There were no recommendation tools. So you'd end up picking three or four B movies, and then you'd pick up five or six for the kids because some of them would be scratched and they wouldn't work. You'd get to the counter. When you got to the counter, you would have to pay your kids' fines off before you got to take away a DVD. It would drive you absolutely crazy. And so when they saw these guys called Netflix come along, and it was Netflix that killed Blockbuster, I want you to imagine what it was like to be sitting in the boardroom at Blockbuster and these scrappy young guys turn up. And what happened was that Netflix started to run out of money quite early on in Netflix's story. And so Netflix thought, well, we'll go to Blockbuster and we'll see if they want to invest in us because we're clearly the future. And Blockbuster looked at them and said, you know, you guys just don't understand the business that you're in. And the kids at Netflix, and they were young, they're kind of like, yeah, we do. And the Blockbuster guys were like, we don't. We have a number of revenue streams. And so the number one revenue stream at Blockbuster, I don't know if any of you can think about what this might be, but the number one revenue stream was fines. And the Netflix model when they first started was that they would mail people DVDs. And you could get five DVDs out, and when you returned them, they would mail you another one, and it was an unlimited period of time. And so they had two revenue streams, and I want you to think about this. They had one, which was the actual DVD rental subscription service that you paid for, and the other one was advertising on the envelopes that went through the US postal system. So Blockbuster looked at them, and Blockbuster said, you know, we have fines. We have DVD rentals and video rentals and game rentals. We sell them secondhand when we're finished with them. And we also have a massive line in confectionery because when people come in to pick up a DVD or a video, you may as well take popcorn and candy and stuff home for the kids. So they looked at their business model, and I want you to get this through your head, that the business model is the thing that really changed between Blockbuster and Netflix. Blockbuster had those four revenue streams, and they thought that these kids from Netflix were utterly crazy because they were talking about a subscription service rather than these four lines of business through. And of course, we saw Blockbuster die. And I recently did a case study on Blockbuster, and one of the things that fascinated me is that 2 weeks before Blockbuster went into receivership, the CIO, so their chief information officer, said, "We're not the least bit worried about Netflix. Our technology is so much better than theirs." And I want you to think about this. Actually, Blockbuster's technology was way better than Netflix's. And so often what happens is we think if we invest in technology that we'll make our businesses work. But the reason that Netflix really, really worked was that they had a business model that worked. When we think about it, people didn't really want to go into a Blockbuster store. They didn't want to go in there to rent DVDs. What they wanted to do is they wanted in-home entertainment. And Netflix found a way to meet that value proposition. Netflix found a way to get them in-home entertainment without the pain and agony of having to go into their stores and without having to pay fines. And so the reason that Blockbuster killed Netflix wasn't because its technology was better, wasn't because it had more options or more branches or anything else. It was purely because they found a value proposition that the customers wanted with a business model that made sense to those customers, which is, I'll just pay a subscription to have you entertain me. So I want you to think a bit about that. The next one is obviously, you know, Borders. Who killed Borders? Well, Amazon killed Borders, right? And one of the big reasons that Amazon killed Borders is that when I buy something at Amazon, and I did it today, right? I went onto Amazon today and I went to buy a book. And what does it give me? It gives me people who bought this bought that offer. So as soon as I started to look around, I suddenly found myself with 10 books in my shopping cart. If I'd gone to Borders, I probably would have gone in, got the book I wanted, and got out. And the average sale at Borders was something like 1.2 books per person. The average sale of books at Amazon is about 2.7. And so what it is, again, is it's nothing to do with selection. It's entirely to do with the offer that they gave. So what's interesting, though, about Amazon is that with the rise of Amazon, we've also had the rise of the independent bookstore. And in fact, those small independent bookstores that have survived have never been as strong as they are now. And so what we've seen is that on one hand, we've got the Amazon business model where it's just so easy. I order it, it gets delivered. They upsell me while I'm there. I buy a bunch of stuff and it's almost put books on subscription. And then on the other hand, what we've got is we've got the independent bookstores where if I go in there, they've got the little cards that say, you know, Sally recommends this book. And if I like Sally's recommendations, then I end up going and buying that book. And so we've found that actually it's stabilized now. And so one of them, the one that is the independent bookstore, it's all about personal recommendation. It's all about what do you think, you know, curated content in a sense. Whereas at the Amazon level, the algorithms are very much just telling me what other people like me might like. And they don't necessarily know what I might like or if I'm a bit like Sally, what it is that Sally might like. But it's interesting here because Borders thought they were too big to fail. And so again, what killed Borders wasn't technology, it wasn't Amazon's tech in any way at all, was that Amazon found a way to have people buy more. And so one of the takeaways that I'd like you to have a think about in relation to this piece is that Amazon made it really, really easy for people to buy from them. And I want you to have a good look at your own businesses and have a think about that. Does my business model make it really, really easy for people to buy from me? And not only does it make it easy for people to buy from me, but does it make it easy for people to find multiple things that they might want from me? Because most businesses that I experience, even on the internet, make it hard for me to buy from them. And they make it hard because the search is horrible or the sign up is horrible or they don't seem to understand what it was that I wanted. So I would really, really encourage you to think long and hard, you know, have I got a good value proposition and have I made it really easy for people to buy from me? So, anyone here have an American Online account? I did. And before I had an AOL account, I used a system that was designed by IBM. And the system that was designed by IBM was actually an early IBM Sears kind of e-commerce platform. And so, again, when I first started using the internet, we weren't allowed to do e-commerce on it. It was entirely for research and purposes. And so, we weren't allowed to sell stuff on it. So when Sears and IBM got together and they thought about a way that would be an electronic clearinghouse for invoicing. And so this electronic clearinghouse for invoicing that they developed had a messaging service in it. And people started using the messaging service and ignoring the electronic invoicing section. And so people like me would pay $40 a month to send 40 messages, and then we would pay whatever they charged us on top. And it was horrendously expensive compared to today's prices. But at the time, it felt like quite a good deal because there was nothing else available that could do instant messaging. And America Online had a look, and they realized that they could offer quite a different business model. So that $40 for 40 messages, they took that and they made it $39.95 a month for unlimited messages. Well, you can imagine that at that point, this really, really took off. And particularly, they did a lot of bundling as well with telcos. And so, America Online just absolutely took off. But something started to happen to them in 2007. And, you don't have to be a math genius to look at this graph and go, this is not the kind of revenue curve that any of us want. So when we look at this revenue curve, clearly, is this a good curve or a bad curve, right? It's a bad curve. And you can see that their subscription revenue is collapsing. And does anyone want to have a guess what it was that took over instead? Well, let's have a look here. Some of you probably made the switch that I made. And this is the revenue curve for Google, and starting here at 2001 from nothing. But it was really 2007 when they really, really cracked their business model. And here, what Google offered me was that it offered me Gmail, which was basically what I had from AOL for $40 a month, but Google offered it to me for free. And so, doing it for free meant that they had to find other revenue models, and they weren't selling me email anymore. They were selling advertising. And so you can see here that they made their first $1 billion pretty much 10 cents at a time. And in that period that AOL was falling off a cliff, these guys got themselves up to almost 18 billion in revenue. And that was off ads, and most of those ads were, under 30 cents each. And so these guys had to have an operating model that was incredibly efficient to do this. So this idea is an interesting one, that over time the price of everything drops. And I want you to keep that in your mind as well as we think about business models, because a lot of people like to think that maybe they could launch a product, they could test it, and then over time they could put the price of it up. I just want to say that that is like opposite to pretty much anything anyone has ever done. And so what happens over time is that the price of everything drops. And if the price of everything drops, then the differentiator has to be something else. And so let's have a think about what those differentiators might be. So Buckminster Fuller, I think you're going to hear a lot about him in the next couple of days. I studied him at university, and so then when I got to business school, I was really delighted to find that he was such a core influence and part of the business school. So he was a famous engineer, and I remember doing this at my business school. We actually built models. I don't know that you're going to get the chance to do that, but it was one of the highlights for me of my business school. And this idea that you can't change things by fighting the existing reality. To change things, you have to build a new model that makes the old model obsolete. And so, if we think about it, what's happened is Gmail, for example, has really made posts, the postal system obsolete. And the postal system globally has been really struggling with what its purpose is and how it's going to survive in the modern era. And a lot of it has picked up things like delivering packages from e-commerce, but that hasn't made up in any way at all for the old model of stamps and postage. And so, everywhere around the world, postal services are becoming privatized, looking at new models for themselves. So, pretty much every industry at some point becomes obsolete and it's replaced by a new model. But the new model is built, just like that first slide that I talked about the future being here, it's just not everywhere yet. The new model is being built before the old model is obsolete. But you can't stand around telling people that they're wrong. So we won't change people by telling them we're wrong. We'll change people by making what they currently do or the way they currently operate just completely irrelevant. So I know that over the next few, or the next week, you're going to have quite a lot to hear about solar. But in particular, I want to show you this. So this is a good graph or a bad graph, and it really depends on your point of view. So that blue line that starts at the top there at over the 350 mark and drops down to $50 there, that is the average cost of energy in North America per megawatt hour. And you can see that over time, pretty much the cost of, you know, wind and winds come down a bit, but they will stay, you know, wind, nuclear, coal, gas, they're all pretty much around the same spot. But over time, what you can see is that the cost of solar is reducing quite fast. Now, this is important because what happened a few months ago is that the cost of both installing and generating solar together is now cheaper than the cost of maintaining nuclear or coal. Should I say that again? So the cost of installing and maintaining solar power is now cheaper than the cost of maintaining nuclear or coal. And why that makes a difference then is that's an example of where the new model makes the old model obsolete. The only way that nuclear and coal can currently operate is where governments subsidize them. And if they don't have subsidies, they're no longer economic to run. Now, that is very interesting for all of us, and it's a fantastic thing for the planet. And it means that we have to be sure that our governments don't subsidize those things, because what they're doing is they're propping up an obsolete business model and an obsolete way of doing things. But I want you to have a bit of a think about what this low solar cost opens up for entrepreneurs. So this is the cost of actual silicon photovoltaic cells. And you can see in the 1970s, they were at $76, and now they're down around 30 cents per watt. So that that curve that you see there, that's a good curve for those of us who might want to use power in the way that we do our work. And I just want you to have a think about a couple of things I'm going to talk about. The last thing I'd say is if you change the scale, then that almost vertical line that you can see there is the price of solar dropping over time. And that's beyond kind of, you know, a hockey stick curve. This is kind of escape velocity curve situation. And this very, very quickly makes all of the other kinds of power production obsolete really fast. So I spend a lot of my life in the food industry. I like food, I eat food, and I work quite a bit in the food sector. And this is a photo of a vertical farm in San Francisco. Now, farming that we all think of as being something that happens, you know, over there out in the countryside. What's fascinating to me here is that the price of solar dropping to zero, which is pretty much what it's doing, combined with excess office space in pretty much every major American city. These two things come together and they make the installation of vertical farms inside our office blocks really, really attractive. And so the business model that works for these vertical farms, there are two of them. One is where they're owned by a restaurant. And this one was owned by a restaurant. And the restaurant owner can basically on a Friday night can say, you know what, on Tuesday I want baby basil. And on Thursday I want baby radicchio. And I want wheatgrass. And they can grow to order. They can walk it around the corner once it's cut from these vacant office blocks to the restaurant. It means that it's got no air miles, it's got very little carbon impact, it's local food, These vertical farms have recently been certified as organic, so they use no pesticides, they use no herbicides. So all of this is really changing the face of particularly vegetable growing. And the second place that this works is that one of the major investors in this kinds of technology are the major supermarkets chains. And so quite a few supermarket chains now are growing vegetables to order inside the supermarket. Now, that business model change means that for the farmers who produce vegetables, they ought to be freaking out, you know. We are always going to produce vegetables. We're always going to eat them. But why wouldn't you produce them in your market around the corner if you can get power for the price of nothing and land for virtually the price of nothing? And here in one office, just basically this big room, which was about a quarter of an acre, I think, they were growing 6 acres of food per quarter acre area. So this is a major shift. And I want to be clear, it's not really the technology that's enabled to do it. It's the economics of what's happened. And it's the old business model being made obsolete that makes this work. Some of you may know what we're looking at here. If you do, we're looking at a Tesla roof. So I own a house. I was thinking about it recently. You know, I have to re-roof. And I thought about it and I thought, you know, I don't really want a roof. You know, like, what do I want a roof for? I have to paint it every 15 years. I've got to replace it. I've got to do all that stuff. And I thought, you know, why in the software industry where I've been for most of my career, we made this move quite a long time ago from selling like installed software, enterprise software, where you had to buy the software and then we would maintain it, to moving to this as a service system where basically you rent software these days. Very few people would own their own software anymore. And I thought about my roof and I thought, how come nobody's offering me a system like that? What I really want is a warm, dry house. I don't really want a roof. How come nobody is leasing me a roof? And then along comes Tesla with this roof. Built into these roof panels are photovoltaics. And so I have a couple of options from a business model point of view. One is that I could buy it outright and I own the roof and I own the power that it produces. Or secondly, what I could do is I could lease the roof from them and we do a deal for the power. Or alternatively, they could install the roof. They own all of the power that comes off that roof and I buy some of my power from them. Now, those are three very different business models, again, that didn't exist even just a year ago. And so that idea of moving to a sharing economy is one that I think you should think about quite a lot. The likelihood is that within the next 5 years, my prediction is that very, very few businesses will still be selling stuff. They will be leasing stuff to people. And I've been working as a futurist with a very large insurance company, one of the world's largest insurance companies. And one of the areas we're working on is we predict that within 5 years, they will have lost almost 60% of their revenue that they get from car insurance. And the reason for that is that people will not be owning cars. And the large car producers will produce cars and then they will lease those cars either to people like Uber or directly to consumers, but they won't be selling those cars. And if they won't be selling those cars, then those cars become as a service. So someone like Ford would lease you the car and guarantee you transport, isn't going to be selling you a car that you then pay to maintain or that you have to insure. And so if the car companies like the Fords of this world or the, you know, the Dubs of this world, if they survive, if those companies are going to be doing it, they will self-insure. There'll be no reason for them to take out insurance because of the size of the fleets they're going to manage. They just won't bother. They'll do it themselves. And this is interesting because Boeing has moved to a model like this. So in New Zealand, their new engines, they don't buy those engines. They used to buy them. And then they would pay maintenance fees. Now what they do is they pay Boeing a fee for every hour that those engines fly, which means that if the engines aren't working or the plane's not in the air, they don't pay Boeing. And so this kind of business model is becoming more and more common around the world. And I would want, and again, invite you to think about how you might change the way you do it. John Deere Tractors is another example. John Deere Tractors has moved from selling tractors to people. They realized people didn't want to own a tractor. What they really wanted was they wanted their field tilled. So they wanted, you know, things dug up, and they wanted planting done. And so now they're selling autonomous tractors, or they're building autonomous tractors, and they're leasing those to farmers. And they realize that the job to be done was actually that tilling work, not people wanting to buy a tractor anymore. And we're going to see this kind of thing changing. It's changing every day. So when we think about companies that really fail, when they often don't see the disruption coming, and the disruption is very rarely technology. The disruption is the business model that is around that technology. So again, when we think about autonomous vehicles, Amazon has already got hundreds of autonomous trucks on the road doing deliveries right now. So the disruption that comes in there is it comes to trucking, it comes to people who are working in trucking, but a lot of it comes from the business model that allows them to do a very different kind of job because they have autonomous trucks. I thought this might interest you. This is a vending machine that sells cars. So this is part of Tmall in China. I can go up to this vending machine. It does a retina scan, takes my credit card, and I can either have it for 3 days for free as a trial, or I can actually buy the car from this vending machine and drive it away. This is a business model disruption. This is, you know, when I went and bought my last car, like I wandered around a car yard, and I can tell you no woman goes to a car yard for fun on a Sunday, right? Nobody would serve me. I had a miserable time. I actually eventually bought my car at an agricultural show, because I knew that it was the last week of the last quarter of the year, and every sales guy at the show was going to have to meet target. And I negotiated like hell and got a great price for my car. But I would have very happily, I'd already done all the research on what I was prepared to pay, what kind of car I wanted, and I would happily have bought it from a vending machine. I had no need to kind of go and be treated like crap on a car yard, which was generally my experience. So thinking about that, this model will revolutionize, if we do stay in the car business, will revolutionize this. So I don't even know if you know this, but Amazon will deliver anything you want in 20 minutes in Manhattan. And part of why it can do that is because, let me back up a step. It'll deliver anything you want in 20 minutes in Manhattan. The nearest warehouse is 40 minutes away in New Jersey. And so some of you think, well, how do we do that? And how they do that is that 3 o'clock in the morning, they fill those trucks up, and then they drive them and they park them up in Manhattan. And they have so much data on what people in Manhattan want that they can deliver something to your block within 20 minutes because they know before you do what you're going to buy. So, you know, Saturdays, it's like, I don't know, condoms and beer or something, and then Mondays it's diapers, and they have so much data now that they can anticipate what you want ahead of you knowing what you want. Now this makes a big difference to the local corner store. So if I can sit at home in the rain, and somebody can deliver me exactly what I want, and it's only 20 minutes, I'm going to stay home and do that. And we've seen that transformation happen with Uber Eats as well, where people are eating in a lot more, but they're not necessarily cooking a lot more since Uber Eats took off. So we've got these business models that have taken like everything up a notch, but the main thing they've done is they've taken service up a notch. And you have to be really thinking in your business, can I anticipate what my customer wants ahead of the customer themselves knowing? And so this whole idea of like customer intimacy and really knowing your customer is more important than ever before. And some of you may have seen this. This is a lesson to the dads out there, you know. So a father very, very publicly complained because Target was targeting, you know, the advertising that you see in your Google stream and your Gmail stream. Target was advertising baby gear to his 17-year-old daughter, and he's like, my daughter's not pregnant, she doesn't need these ads, and he really went public on it, you know, watch out, dads. And Target came back and they said, look, she's pregnant, and the father's like, no, she's not. And then they're like, yeah, we know that if you buy cotton balls, unscented lotion and mineral supplements, you're pregnant. And she was. And so what I would say again in there is that those algorithms, being able to really know what your customer wants and what they're about, is incredibly important today. So this dad might have found that creepy, but at the same time, they were actually right. So 2016 was the last year that humans ran the internet. And I want you to have a think about this again. So by 2017, more than 50% of the traffic on the internet was bots. So in 2016, 48% of the traffic on the internet was humans. And what it was that 22% are good bots, 28% are like those hackers and spammers and people who are, you know, trying to put porn on your site. But these good bots, these are things like, anyone here got a Fitbit? You know, the Fitbits that are connected to your scales, that might be connected to your iPhone. But this Internet of Things traffic is really now on its way to becoming the biggest traffic on the internet. And I would say that within the next year or so, it will well be 50% of the traffic on the internet will be those good bots. So the connected home, sensors telling me when I want things and when I don't. I want you to think about how we might put all of this stuff together. So I've talked about like the vertical farms because electricity reduces in price. I've thought about fulfillment and how Amazon's really smart at knowing what I might want. This is a test that Amazon and Campbell Soup have done together, and they had a previous iteration that was much more simple. It was a fridge magnet that if you pushed it, it dropped a Campbell Soup can into your Amazon shopping cart. This is a little magnetized scanner. And so what I can do is I can scan everything as I put it into the fridge, and I can scan it as it comes out. And as it comes out, it automatically puts it into my Amazon shopping cart. And then when I go to review my Amazon shopping cart, it basically assumes I want it. And if I don't, I can take it out. And very, very soon, these kinds of scanners will be built directly into our fridges. And so they will scan themselves in and scan themselves out. And I've played with a bunch of these with RFID codes in them already. And, you know, what that does is it, again, makes it really easy to change our business models. And I want you to get this bit, is that in the old days, like, I'm not really a soup kind of drinker, but Campbell Soup realized that they were just selling individual products. And what they needed to do was to work out how to change it from a product to a service, right? Just like that Tesla roof changed the roof from a product to a service. And so what they wanted to do was to basically think about a subscription service for soup. But nobody was really going to sign up for a soup a week. But by doing the scanning system in and out of the fridge, what they do is that they change your shopping behavior from being a single purchase item to being a subscription item. And I want you to, again, think about what that means for you as a business model, because everything is becoming a subscription service. So I want you to write that down. One of the biggest changes in business models that we're seeing in this current part of our century is that everything is moving from being a thing to being a service, so from a product to being a service. And it's happening everywhere. And then when we think about some of the things that we're now putting in our homes, whether it's Alexa, whether it's the new Facebook portal, whether it's, you know, Google or Apple, I'm putting my money down on Alexa winning. And the reason I'm putting my money down on Alexa winning is Alexa's got a really clear business model When I talk to Alexa, it's helping me to buy things. It's helping me to deliver things. It's got a very, very clear revenue model that goes around it. I don't know about the Google one. I'm still watching. I can't see that the Facebook portal has a future because I can't figure out the business model for it. I can't figure out how it's going to make the money. And I don't really want, if any of you have looked at it, you know, I don't really want face recognition sitting on my fridge. You know, I run through the house in the middle of the night for a glass of water. I don't need it recognizing me. And then the Apple one may well work just because product design is beautiful and there is a market for high-end products. But you heard it from me, I'm picking that Alexa as the winner here. And the reason I think it's the winner is because it has a business model behind it that makes it very, very easy. So you think about that thing I said, make it easy for people to buy from you and make it easy for them to buy more. This is a model that will work. So this is the Google one. This is the growth in Internet of Things. So you can see it's about to get to escape velocity. It's in a really high curve. I'm particularly interested in the smart cities, smart homes, connected cars and wearables, but I'm sure others of you will be interested in other areas as well. But again, the faster that all of these machines around us, and machines might be as small as our watch, but the faster they all start talking to each other, the more opportunities that is for entrepreneurs when we really think about big problems that we might want to solve for people and how we might want to solve them. Whoops. This is an interesting one because it's a New Zealand bank, but I'm seeing it with banks all around the world where they basically are moving and seeing themselves. We're a technology company that's licensed to provide banking and financial services. And so the companies that are really thinking about their digital models are surviving. But what I would say about digital transformation is that digital transformation has to be done from the customer's point of view. So again, I come back to Amazon, or they're working because they're really thinking hard about what it is that the customer wants and how to make the customer experience as good as they can. And the same for Apple. So these big banks, they're going to become obsolete. Again, not because we don't need banking. I'm still going to need banking. That they're going to become obsolete because their models are not going to work in the future. They've got big, old, clunky enterprise systems, software systems behind them. Peer-to-peer lending, all those things are going to completely transform banking, and they're not ready for it. So I don't think that they're going to go down easily. But again, I'm putting my money down on them disappearing in a big way. So there's this idea that I've been talking about all the way through here, which is that there are no disruptive technologies, only disruptive business models. And so really want you to think about that the technology is a tool that an entrepreneur uses. The technology is not the thing. So here's a couple of new business models. Uber, sorry, that's a bit scratchy, that picture, but I don't know if any of you had to catch a taxi recently. It's a miserable experience compared to Uber. The reason that Uber works so well isn't because they've got an app. It's because they've really thought end-to-end about what my actual problem is. So I live in a country where it rains a lot. I love that I can watch that little kind of cockroachy like car and run out of the house at the right time when they're pulling up. I love that I can, you know, get to my destination and we pull up outside and I get out of the car and they email me an invoice or a receipt. My PA, my assistant, sorts out whether that's getting invoiced to anybody. It's really straightforward. The service is great. The conversation's good. The music's good. The car doesn't smell. Right, I catch a taxi and they're late and I stand in the rain and I phone the taxi company three or four times to see if they're still coming, and they tell me they are, but I have no idea when. And when they finally turn up, I'm running late for my meeting, and I get to my meeting and then we park outside and we have this horrible transaction with my credit card, and then half the time the credit card thing doesn't work and they get a machine out, and then I have to remember to get a receipt, and then I have to take a photograph of that receipt and email that to my assistant, and like the entire experience is miserable. So for me, what Uber has done is that Uber has transformed the model of getting me somewhere. But I feel a bit sorry for the drivers because what's happening in my hometown is that the drivers are abandoning the taxi system. So to buy a taxi license in Wellington, where I live, was 95 grand 2 years ago. It's 10 grand now. And I realize that these guys who are moving over to drive for Uber, they're going to be obsolete in a few years too, because Uber is setting this whole network up to be able to unleash their automated systems, their autonomous cars. And so, you know, there's a point again where the business model of Uber will change one more time. So it will still be about great service. It will still be about all the automation. But as soon as they're able to do it, they're going to flip it one more time. Taxi companies just can't compete with that. Where they could compete is that they could hang on. And instead of being a product in the future, they could turn themselves into an extraordinary experience. But they don't have the vision to do it. And so one of the ways that you have to compete against free, in a sense, which is where Uber is going, is it becomes almost free to deliver that kind of service in the future. The way that you compete with free is that you have the best possible experience for your customers. You know, I predicted the combination of Whole Foods and Amazon when I was doing some work for a client. But what I find interesting now is that they're now bringing, you know, it right into the supermarket. And so Amazon's ability to sell meat right in the supermarket and deliver that to people's homes is again going to transform what's happening in the entire food system. So, you know, these disruptions, again, it's not a technological disruption. This is a business model where Uber getting, Amazon getting deep into the food system is changing the entire economics of the food system itself. I don't know if any of you have had the Impossible Burger. A lot of people are very excited about the tech. I love the burger. But the thing that is different here about the burger compared to producing animal meat, a large piece of it is actually the business model. So if you're a farmer, you sell your stock. Your stock goes on a truck. It goes to a slaughterhouse. It's then picked up by a distributor who takes it into the market, and then it's sold from that market into some wholesalers, and then from the wholesalers into the retailers and food service. A lot of people along that chain all wanting to take a piece of the pie, and the farmer actually gets the smallest amount of profit in that entire chain. With the Impossible Burger, what's really interesting to me is that they buy the inputs from the farmer and then they control the rest of the chain. So the Impossible Burger is doing the production in their factory, and then they're doing their own distribution and their own, at the moment, straight to food service. And they've just announced they'll be distributing directly to supermarkets next year. So they have changed the value chain completely, and they can hold on to that same profit that at the moment is going across about 20 players in the meat industry. So on one hand, there's the disruption of the technology that's involved here, but mostly what I can see around the Impossible Burger, around Beyond Meat and around the others, is that it's a business model disruption. The supply chains are so much more efficient in these alternate proteins than they are in farming and meat production, that it's that I think farmers should be worried about, not whether or not more people are going to become vegetarians, which they clearly already are. I'm going to move past this. Interesting too, when I look at the food industry, the people who are doing really well are the ones maybe who have taken food and done other things with it. So up the top there is a picture of a pericardium. It's a repair being done to a heart, and it's done actually using beef pericardium that's come from a New Zealand bull. That beef has been triple washed. It used to go to pet food, and it used to be at about something like 14 cents a kilo. It's now a highly precision milled product, and it goes for about $2,500 a kilo. And so the same, it's a piece of beef heart used to go to pet food, now goes to repair human hearts. And so they've found a completely different place for that product, and a product that is really high value. This fountain one I want to show you is that I can buy gelatin at my local supermarket for, I think it's $1.29 for a couple of hundred grams. And it's really low value. Gelatin is, you know, it's made from, I'm sorry if anyone might be grossed out, but it's, you know, it's largely made from the noses. I know people think it's hooves, but the noses and the ears of cattle. And so that gelatin is powdered, goes to the supermarket, very low value product, even in Jell-O, right? Really low value product. But here is almost exactly the same product, repackaged as collagen, repackaged as a beauty supplement. And so here, when you think about things coming to zero, actually the input, the gelatin input has now got to a point where it's really at zero. It costs a couple of cents for what is the inputs into this product. But the entire value that is around this product is based on what it will do for me. So if this is going to make my skin more beautiful and I'm going to feel more fabulous, then I'm willing to pay the $40 or whatever it is. And what surprises me is I think they could have put grass-fed organic on this and got another $10. So it's worth thinking about what the attributes are and what it is that the value is to the customer. So here we have what I grew up with being called stock, which was, you know, your boiled bones. And then my grandmother would make me drink what was called beef tea to make me stronger. And it was basically boiled up bones. And again, here we are here. Can you guys see that? Give me a second. I'm just fighting with my technology now. I can't actually hear you, so I don't know what you can see. Oh, I'm so sorry. Sorry about this. Oh. Can someone tell me what you can see? Oh, there you go. Sorry about that. Bit of technology fun. Okay. So this is what was basically big P. It's now sold as, you know, an immune joint gut health. This is my favorite butcher in London. You can see it doesn't look like a butcher. They sell cheese, they sell wine. What they realized is they weren't really in the meat business. They were in the business of selling people dinner. And so if they were in the business of selling people dinner, then they needed to be selling a lot more of the meal than just meat. And so, you know, really thinking more clearly about, I just want you to think about subscription businesses as the very last thing before I finish up. And so everything, if I said to you, you know, if you can change from a product to a service, what we're doing at the moment at our place is that we're buying avocados as a service. I used to go down and buy them at my local supermarket, and now we have boxes of them delivered. These are a family farm where the meat that my family eats gets delivered direct from this farm. We like the way they farm. They're regenerative farmers. They do free-range organic meat, and it's delivered direct to our door. And these guys are interesting. They're a lamb company that only do three culls a year, and again, they deliver, but only on the dates that works for them. And it's incredibly high-value, amazing food. So what you can see is that people will pay more and more and more for convenience. And one of the biggest conveniences you can have is to move them from buying an individual product to a subscription. So I'm going to think about this last area, which is that we always overestimate the change that will occur in the next 2 years, and we underestimate the change that will occur in the next 10. And don't let yourselves be lulled into inaction. And so what I would say in there, from like Mr. Fuller had the last word, is that there's nothing in a caterpillar that tells you it's going to be a butterfly. And if you've ever actually thought about what happens, as the caterpillar goes through a phase where it basically becomes primordial goo before it becomes the butterfly. And in that primordial goo phase, you have no idea what it was in the past or what it was in the future. And when we think about the turmoil and disruption that is occurring around us in terms of businesses, the big changes that we're seeing are not technological, actually. The big changes that we're seeing is that old business models are falling away, like coal and like nuclear, and they're being replaced with new business models. But often these new business models have to stumble around for a little while before they find them. So the last things I want you to think about is, how do you make it easy for your customers to buy from you? How do you get to know what they want before they do? And then how do you turn your businesses from being product companies, if they're product companies, into services companies? Or if you're a service company currently, how do you turn that into being a product company so that you have both? Thanks a lot.